I'm on meetings like 5 hours a day now, and it really sucks.
Yeah, it's been happening to me lately too. It's the worst.
Yeah.
I'm headed that route because we've got a big CRM project that's we're launching.
Like, what's your right now. Platform?
Tessitura.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah.
I have so many CRM certifications. I've never even heard of that one.
Yeah. Well, we're also a not-for-profit. So like we only hit a certain threshold. Yeah. Yeah. The cheaper we can get. And there's certain CRM providers that cater specifically to the not-for-profit. So even though they do some pretty decent solutions, like the amount of things you can do, like the amount of customers you can handle, but the depth isn't quite the same. And it's like catered to who is the person and how much are they worth so that we can ask them for donations and that kind of thing.
Get the Salesforce not-for-profit licensing with the not-for-profit success pack. I do not have a certification in that because it is awful.
Yeah, Salesforce was pitched and we didn't go any farther.
Very expensive.
Yep. Yes, it was. I think Salesforce was one of the ones we dumped because of feature. Like, the features weren't there for what we were wanting. Because we're also doing ticketing and we're trying to meld all these things together instead of having a bunch of separate solutions, which is what we've been dealing with for 40 years.
Our company, instead of just implementing a system that works once, my company has attempted to implement a bad solution that is cheaper 5 or 6 times now. So we are just about to transition to a very bad platform. And no one is happy about it.
Instead that sounds about right.
Not wasting our time. Like, I know what my bill rate is, and I know the amount of hours that have been spent on this, and it's not cheaper. We haven't saved any money. We've saved no money.
Yeah, my company's been kind of doing similar things, more to do with actually constantly doing more and more outsourcing, and then they've outsourced so much to, third-party ITs. Companies now that they've started playing the shell game of trading who's in charge of what, and it's all terrible.
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing that I found with larger companies, and when they do that, is that I've never worked in a large company. I'll just put that out there. I've always worked in small and medium sized, mostly consulting companies. But I found that when a company gets to a certain size, the bureaucracy overhead to get anything done becomes so unmanageable, you have to go outside of the company to hire someone who can do something without getting bungled up in that red tape.
Project management becomes, it's literally a job. We hire entire people whose only job is to manage the internal red tape and resources necessary to accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. That's effectively the organization my job is with. I'm part of the effort to just keep our wheels turning, which is really a frustrating job to have. Also, the whole, Tony was saying, to make it cheaper, right? That's always what they say. Oh, we're making these changes to make it cheaper. Actually, David was saying that. And that's what all of these outsourcing contracts and shuffling around is always to do. It's like, all right, well, we need to cut the bottom line. Because we're not making enough money, so we're going to be cheaper by having cheaper contracts with somebody else to do all this work for us. And what ends up happening of that everybody who isn't at a executive level seems to immediately recognize is the bottom line on how much money you spend on IT resources goes down. The invisible cost to productivity skyrockets.
But there's zero quantifiable ROI on IT.
Right.
You just don't have it. It's just all tribal value.
Well, that was, I mean, that was something interesting that they were trying when I was at Bank of America. Like, this was 20 years ago now, but the IT department, they treated the IT department like consultants. And it was like, it was really interesting because for the longest time, it's like, if you had the ear of an IT person, you just held onto that IT person. You had them do everything you could until some executive pulled them away for another project. What they finally said is, you know what? IT gets like every department gets its own budget. So, but IT got a much smaller budget. One second. I'm getting a delivery here. Thank you.
Look at that service with a smile and a salute.
You can close the door. Thanks. But what they did was, they said, all right, IT gets a minuscule, just like administrative budget, but any work that you did for any department, you build. Mm-hmm. And so if a department wanted if they wanted reporting built, all right, well, have IT build the reporting, but
you got to pay for it.
You got to pay them for it. Yeah. And that's like it. It works so much better that way. Like the IT staff was so much happier because they weren't being pulled by, you know, Joe exec wants you to completely redesign this report because, you know, he wants the name in the upper left on every report ever. And they're all on the upper right. So we have to redesign all these reports. All right, fine.
That was basically my previous role in my current company.
Yeah. And they're like, it was fine.
Terrible.
Fine. Here is the cost. and it's like, if you still want it, then you got to pay for it. You got to pay for it out of your department's budget.
Yep.
So, and it worked out so much better for him. Now it's just like the Wild West where I'm at, but we're also a not-for-profit. Like, fortunately I've been there for 12 years now. So I know, the most of the politics and I know, all right. I have this project that somebody will come to me and say, hey, I need this help with this. And it's like, fine, but you're in line behind the president's office and HR. And they're like, all right, well, how many months is that going to be before you can help me? Like, they just understand. It's like, all right. For a while there, I was working with the finance office for some stuff. It's like, well, I'm with the finance office. Well, how important is that? I don't know. How important is it that you get a paycheck? Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
You know where else bureaucracy can bite you? In our federal courtroom in 1969.
Oh, can't it?
Can't it? All right, let's get this shit started.
Hey, this is Tony.
This is Eric.
And this is David.
And we're the Backseat Producers.
First off, yesterday was Tony's birthday.
It was.
So, and birthday, a big one, as I understand it.
Yeah. I have begun my sixth decade now.
Well, it's like the second half century.
Yeah, well, that too.
Congratulations.
Yeah, like when I hit 25, as one of my friends, actually, who's no longer a friend of mine, put it, so you're halfway to 50, which means you're halfway to dead.
I mean,
yeah, okay.
All right.
I mean, I've been there for a while, I think.
50 feels like a real aggressive halfway to dead timeline.
Well.
Yeah, now halfway to 50, which is halfway to dead, I could see.
Yeah.
No, well, he was saying halfway to 50, so you're like halfway to death.
No, he said you're halfway to 50, which is halfway to dead.
Right, but I think you could take that, like, if they're as equivalent, right? Like 25 is 50% to 50.
Right.
And also 50% to dead, meaning the 50 is still
you're
dead.
You're 25%. No. He was saying that it was 25%. That was 25%.
Well, call him up. He needs to be more clear in his wording.
No, I'm not. We are no longer on speaking terms.
And well, not just, you know, because what? He was threatening your mortality.
Yeah, no kidding. But, you know, if he, you
oh,
know,
he was also like a casual racist when he was in his teens, and he never grew out of it. Like, there was a lot of casual racism in the 80s that was part of the mores, and he just never grew out of it as society changed.
You were friends with Stephen Miller?
I don't know who that is, honestly.
He's really racist.
Okay.
He was basically the guy who ran President Trump's immigration policy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He okay. looks a lot like Jeff Bezos, but like is worse.
Sure. All right. So tonight we're going to talk about the trial of the Chicago Seven. David, what did you think of this?
So I did not expect to like this movie, and so I turned it on earlier this afternoon while I was working, and I did not work for the 2 hours this movie ran. I could not tear myself away from the movie, and that is not something that normally happens to me.
Eric, what'd you think?
Honestly, I was kind of in the same boat. Like, I went in, and I will say, like, it was, I spent 2 hours basically being mad. because it is intensely frustrating to watch, you know, these based on historical events happening. And I did the same thing, actually. I put it on my laptop while I was working today, and then that was basically what I was focused on for a little while. Although I did at least slip in my lunch break in there. It was. I mean, it's a frustrating movie to watch, but it was really gripping. And I was afraid that going into it, that it was going to be something we had talked about on a prior episode of like, you know, boomer 60 porn, basically. And I mean, there's elements of that, obviously, given what it's all about. But I thought it did a really, really good job. I mean, the whole thing is a very, very well made production. And I got to the end, I was like, okay, I was mad for 2 hours, but I found the dialogue oddly entertaining the entire time. And then it pops up a film by Aaron Sorkin. I'm, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. 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 I had a very similar experience, except for me, I had the day off. So, like, Aaron's been binge watching just whatever she can. And I think she finally hit her threshold of Simpsons episodes that she could watch, because I think she's in like season 25 now.
That bums me out.
It's just ridiculous that like she is just every episode, just one after another. She took a break to watch rewatch A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Which one?
The Netflix show.
The Netflix. Yeah. Just this.
All oh, the it. Series. Yeah.
The series. Yeah.
That one was a movie.
Watch all of it. And now she's rewatching The Good Place. So, I needed to watch the movie, and Julie and I had intended to watch it over the weekend, and things just got away from us. And, so I finally was like, I have to watch this movie today. I'm going to go upstairs. So I went up to the bedroom and put the movie on and lay down in bed and watched it. And it was like, I was just riveted the whole time. Normally I'm playing around on my phone or something. I just kind of stopped doing that, watched the movie and got angrier. Yeah. I took a short break to go downstairs and grab a couple of peanut butter chews that were made for me as my birthday treat. Went right back up and jumped right back into the movie. Cause it was just like, it was riveting. And I was really, really angry.
Like, I did learn the trick like real early on. Like, whenever anything good happens, just expect it to be taken away from me immediately.
Yeah.
And then that saves me a lot of heartache.
Yeah, that's what happened frequently.
Yep.
So let's just jump right in. One of the things I found interesting was how closely related to Judas and the Black Messiah this was. I didn't realize it until that first 10 minutes and they're introducing people and just popping names up. And it was like, wait a minute, Fred Hampton.
I know
that name.
Yeah. Cause these filmed at about the same time. So I knew that I knew he was in this, but I was thinking back to Judas and the Black Messiah. And I don't remember. I think Bobby Seale actually shows up in Judas and the Black Messiah. Like, they're hiding him out for a bit. I think he might be the guy who rolled through.
I think so. I don't recall specifically. Remember. Yeah. Yeah, it was just, I found that really interesting how those two movies kind of touch tips.
Yeah, here's a distressing thing I discovered earlier today. I don't normally give a shit about history. I just find the subject to be like absolutely boring. And like, so the majority of my life has been around nerds and like, you know, mostly nerd dudes, which cannot stop jerking off about World War II. It's just like, if you're a new nerd dude and you enjoy history at all, it's World War II. And that's like, that's your thing.
That's
like,
the go-to.
That's the go-to. And it's like, fuck, this could not be any less interesting to me. Just like the war is not interesting. But after Judas and the Black Messiah and this movie, it's like, Jesus Christ, am I getting into like the 60s history? Because it's like every time I uncover some new decade or some new artifact of American history, it's like, oh, well, this is also awful, but like also is really interestingly awful. And I don't know. It's just the whole, like, I don't want to be this person now.
And yet here you are.
And here I am.
You're getting old. That's all there is to
it. It has to be.
So I was a big part of what I took away from watching the movie was thinking about the kind of the concept of history too, in that, and I haven't watched Judas and the Black Messiah, so I didn't have that to compare it to, but you know, I knew about a lot of the major events that the movie covers, right? Like I knew about the Chicago riots in I think it was 69 was when the movie was actually set.
Nice.
I knew about the trial. I knew about the murder of Fred Hampton by the police in Chicago. But I didn't realize how much it all overlapped. And obviously, based on what the movie shows, that there is some very potentially direct ties between those events. And I didn't know a lot of that and the context of it, because this is stuff that doesn't get taught in your average American school for history. You don't learn this in history class when you're growing up. Not on average anyway. I mean, maybe there are some classes and some schools and some places that do. But in my experience, especially in, you know, in white suburban America, this is the type of history that doesn't get taught in school.
I have never taken a history class where police brutality has been a topic. In any concept whatsoever. We're talking like the old slave patrol. What was the origination of our police? Like not even with those, talking about those, like it has just never been addressed as a topic in history, which is utterly baffling to me. Although, I guess not that baffling to me. I completely understand why. Like, I get it.
Well, because it's still got a direct modern repercussion. Like, we learn, I mean, American history tends to be taught with a certain amount of, let's make sure that everybody loves America, right? There's a nationalistic rah-rah aspect to our education system that's been there forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll teach you some of the stuff that was like, well, that was bad. And we know that now looking back on it. Like, they'll teach you about, all right, we probably shouldn't have gone around actually having our army slaughter Native Americans. That was probably a bad idea. We're not going to tell you about how reservations are set up in the modern day, but, you know.
Yep.
And, okay, Roosevelt putting all of the Japanese people in camps in World War II, probably not the greatest look for us.
Did you learn about that? Because I didn't.
I did.
It was glossed over, but yeah, I do remember hearing about it.
But you know, in a way, those are events that exist solely in history now, right? There isn't, or hasn't been exactly until more recently, modern day implications of them. Whereas if you learn about the racist origins of the police, that directly impacts your view of the police right now, which is, there is this massive force that exists to try and sell people on the idea that they're not only good, they're an essential staple of every part of the fabric of our society. Mm-hmm. That, like, without them being there exactly as they are right now, it would all fall apart.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is baffling to me, but
yeah.
But the propaganda machine around it is really good.
And Yeah, and I mean, the same kind of propaganda exists for our military too, right? I remember the first time I read some investigation into like the amount of money and influence that the military has in Hollywood to make sure that if you film anything about the U.S. military, it's going to be positively spun at the end of the day.
Yep. Yeah, to get the stamp of approval on a movie is a big deal for Hollywood because it can mean funding, it can mean distribution, it can mean things like recommendations, like the Stars and Stripes. If the Stars and Stripes gives your movie a positive review, that, you know, and it's a military movie and it's been rubber stamped by the media arm of that military, that's a big deal. And you will get a portion of the population that will go see the movie just because of that. You know, there was a portion of the people that would see Top Gun just because it was, you know, it got the stamp. You know, it was a movie that was approved.
Those were the people who were going to see it for that volleyball scene.
Yeah. Because you got to get that right.
Yeah, you got to get that right. I had like 15 consultants in for that volleyball scene.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny, that movie. We watched it not too long ago, and the more I see the movie, like watching it, you know, as a young teen, it was like, oh, Maverick is, you know, he's the badass, he's the one, he is so cool. Why are these guys giving him grief? And I'm like, you know what? Ice had it right. Val Kilmer's character is just correct all the way through. Like, there is nothing wrong with anything that he says. Yeah, like when I was a kid, he was the asshole, but he's only the asshole because he's the man trying to shut down the wild card. It's like, yeah, you're gonna get somebody killed. Oh wait, you did get somebody killed. Yeah, and it's like, oh man, what a dick for saying that.
Well,
yeah, bud.
Tony, I've never seen Top Gun, to be honest with you.
Ugh.
Everything I know about it is from the cultural zeitgeist, which is probably Maverick, enough, Iceman, really, and the volleyball scene. And I know nothing else about the movie.
You know the Danger Zone.
Well, I do. Yeah, I mean, actually, I know Danger Zone more from Arch.
Yeah, I know.
Top Gun.
Yeah, I mean, growing up on a military base, on military bases, I understand intimately how the military is protective, how protective it is of itself. You know, there were bars, you know, or restaurants. If something bad happened and they didn't treat somebody in the military right, they could get blackballed. Mm-hmm. And if it's close enough to a military base and a restaurant or bar is blackballed, you might as well just shutter it. Like, it just, you're not going to get any business. When the military base is the employer for the area, that, you know, it'd be like a mining town and being shitty to the miners. You just, that's it. You're done.
Or a college town that,
yeah,
alienates the entire college population.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They start carding.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
So I think the reason that I at least got as sucked into this as I did, in spite of kind of going in with a negative attitude, you know, expecting it to be 60s porn and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Aside from just a very, very good script and some really great performances by some of the actors in it, was, you know, with everything that's been going on for the last, you know, 8 to 12 years, there was so much immediate relevancy in, yeah, the cultural and political events that it was depicting, that we see reflected in the modern day. And the one that just kept smashing me in the face, and the thing that I probably kept getting the angriest about, was that asshole judge. Because, you know, we've had a third of our federal judges effectively appointed in the last 4 years, right? And, yeah, at the federal level, they're lifetime appointments. These aren't judges you vote on, for all that voting on judges ever matters or changes anything, because no one ever knows. For even on the local level, no one knows what the who the judges are and what they do. But at the federal level, it's just, all right, they get appointed and they're there, whether or not they belong there, and whether or not they're rated by anyone of being qualified. And you see that with this guy in this this judge in this movie. I mean, he's terrible. He's clearly biased. He's clearly making rulings based on his own preconceptions of what the outcome is supposed to be.
Yep.
He's rooting for the prosecution for all intents and purposes, and willing to look the other way in the face of obvious like problems, like the jury tampering with the two jurors who got the threatening letters, and the judge is like, nope, yep, got to toss them.
Yeah. Yep. This is definitely the Panthers. It's funny because Judas and the Black Messiah, they the police, the FBI or whatever, makes up, like, writes these letters, and like the shit they put in there is exactly what you expect to be a bunch of white dudes trying to write in a black voice.
These giant honkies.
They end the letter with "dig in."
Yeah,
it's like, wait, have you ever heard them say "dig in"? Well, yeah, surely that's what they say.
So they send it to one black group, and like the Panthers roll in, and the guy's like, "Why are you sending these letters to us?" And he's like, "Dude, did you read this letter?" This sounds like a bunch of fucking white people wrote this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just funny that that was I guess not funny, but so that was, I mean, obviously the current cultural relevance struck me, but what I thought was really good about it was, like, it was overt, but it didn't feel like it was shoehorned in, because we have the same fucking problems now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't trying to make our problem map our problems back then in an unnatural way. It was, oh, we haven't actually fixed anything.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can look back and I hope that things aren't quite this egregious now.
I think the
judges aren't as arrogant about it today.
I don't think they're as egregious in the same way.
No, I think it's just as bad. But I don't think it's as blatant.
I mean, I don't but then you read news stories about a judge who makes them enter a two-year-old Mexican stand trial for their own immigration case.
Right. Well, and those aren't Americans. That's the difference.
And you read about a judge who decides to give a slap on the wrist sentence to Brock Turner because, mm-hmm. well, he's got his whole life ahead of him just because he raped someone. I mean, we don't want to ruin his life, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's story after story about judges all around America who still do these, like, mind-blowing things that, you know, you take a step back and look at it in context, and you're just like, who can rationally make this decision? And it's happening. You know, there are still judges who are willing to make that decision and be clearly completely convinced of the rightness of their acts. So I don't know that it's really any better in that regard.
Yeah,
and with the police brutality, I mean, just look at every protest for Black Lives Matters that's happened over the past, whatever, 4 to 6 years, or whatever it's been. I mean, it's the National Guard with even more militarized gear than they had in the 60s. That hasn't changed.
Actually, particularly relevant right now because the Chauvin trial for the murder of George Floyd is happening, like, presently.
Right now.
The day, yeah. Well, probably not right now.
Well, not right now, but yeah.
Middle of the fucking night, but... So when that guy's acquitted, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the acting a little bit.
Yeah.
Sacha Baron Cohen. I think he was. I think he was a rock star in this one.
He's very talented. He's so talented.
Everything you know, he just is surprising. And this was just another one, another thing he did that was surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've never actually sat down and watched a Borat movie, either Borat movie. It's honestly not my brand of humor. I've seen bits of them, but I don't find it entertaining.
But have you seen Madagascar?
I have not actually.
Oh, well.
But I should. I've seen even from the bits of Borat where I've seen his work, and in other places where I've seen Sacha Baron Cohen, the guy's a genius. I mean, clearly.
He's really funny.
Yeah, I used to watch Da Ali G Show when that was on HBO, and like actually own the DVDs of it. Just because, like, I was a big fan, and it's like, oh wait, they're turning that one character from that into a movie. Yeah, sure, I'm gonna go watch Borat. And so, I've seen both movies. I saw the first one in the theaters, and when the second one came out, we watched it on HBO Prime, like the weekend it came out. His style of humor is not for everyone, but the things that he gets people to admit to just by putting them in uncomfortable circumstances and just talking them through it, it's incredible the things that he gets people to admit to. Like, it really is. At one point, because he has a new show, I think it's on Showtime. But there's a video out there where he got a bunch of senators to say, yeah, we should be arming children. Like, we should be putting guns in their hands when they go to school to protect themselves. And it was and you could see, like, he clipped the interview together to make it seem really, really damning. But if you watch it, you can see how he did it and how he got these people to just step into this stuff and just build up on it and like build that energy towards admitting these things, that it's like, holy shit, it's incredible that these people are saying these things. Even if they're coerced into saying them, they're still saying the words. It's not like he's using editing tricks or anything like that to take things out of context. He is getting them to say full sentences that are incredibly damning.
Yeah, I mean, but the problem with a lot of those like real far out there opinions is that you're going to defend the opinion, and then like once you start getting down that road of like the logical next step, like you have two options. You can either call out the nuances, or you can just double down on it. And like the double down is a lot easier.
Yeah. 99% of people just are going to double down.
And they do.
Why? Cause you can't have nuanced opinions. Like, a nuanced opinion is not a strong defense of your original opinion.
If you're trying to, this is the problem. In many ways, like a duel of wits, your argument isn't about you and the person you're arguing it with. It's about everybody watching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And if you're the one who's trying to go nuanced, then everyone else who's seeing this play out is going to think, oh, well, this is the guy who doesn't actually believe in what he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, they don't actually have the conviction. So clearly their ideas must not be great ideas.
Yeah. This is a weaker argument.
So going to Sacha Baron Cohen's actual portrayal in this movie, I think it's very much the strength of the type of character that he likes to play, which is the character with somebody who appears absurd,
mm-hmm.
Who in the context, you know, in the fiction and as a viewer, you're kind of in both places, you're kind of supposed to not take him seriously. And then it turns out he's like the smartest guy in the room. The scene that really sold me on the character was the scene where they're having the argument in Conspiracy Central, conspiracy offices, where the
lawyer and Tom Hayden.
Thank you. Where Tom Hayden and him are basically having a giant argument, and Tom Hayden wants to get put on the stand, and Sasha's character comments on the fact that, hey, you didn't actually mean what that tape makes it sound like you meant. because, and he starts doing like a literary evaluation of the way he writes his speeches. And then the character Tom kind of looks at him like, what?
He's like, oh yeah, I've read everything you've ever written.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, that right there. I mean, I knew going in that this was a Sorkin movie, but the elegant way that all pieced together was really good. Was really good. And when they were doing the faux cross examination of, yeah, here is why you are not going to be the one to go on the stand, and he plays that tape, and he, like, it's the scene from A Few Good Men, but thank God we didn't let him get on the stand. You know, it's kind of like that. Like, this is that moment that he would have just eviscerated. He would have been eviscerated on the stand. And that's why Sacha Baron Cohen, you know, that's why, blanking on his name now, his character was the perfect one to be put up there. Was it Abby Hoffman? Abby Hoffman. Yeah. That's him. That was the perfect point to put him up there. I thought Eddie Redmayne was really good.
Why were there so many British actors in this goddamn movie?
What amused the shit out of me was at one point I did look down and was on my game and I was like, I didn't know Travolta was in this movie. And I looked up and it's Eddie Redmayne talking. His American accent sounds incredibly close to Travolta's voice. It is. Huh. Like,
That's Travolta.
Yeah, it was.
The actor that caught me off guard, I will say, I went into this I knew basically nothing other than the basic subject matter. Like I said, I didn't know it was an Aaron Sorkin film. I didn't know who was going to be in it. So when Michael Keaton showed up as Ramsey Clark, that was phenomenal.
Yeah. I did not know he was in it either.
I saw his name on the list, but I forgot because there's so many names. There were so many names on the list. And I had just completely forgotten he was one of them. Like,
his give no shits portrayal of the former attorney general was maybe the highlight of the film for me, actually, was his part. And then it was kind of like what you said, David, where you learned very quickly to just not buy into anything good that's happening.
Yeah.
I kind of got there too, and then I fell for that one. Yep. And when the judge basically just tosses it all, I was just like, that was heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And then his last line, get working on the appeal. Like,
yeah.
The appeal is how they got acquitted.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I'm sorry. The appeal, the DOJ declined to
re-prosecute the case. Yep. Like, right. the appeal basically got, I don't know if it was officially a mistrial or what, but they basically tossed the first trial.
Yep.
And then the DOJ was just like, all right, we're not going through that again.
They're not going to defend it. Yeah, they're not going to defend the appeal. So that's it.
But yeah, Keaton's whole performance was phenomenal for the small part it played. Mm-hmm. And it gave that impression as he was leaving, like, you know, he knew that he showed up and then none of it was going to get used. Yep. At the same time, he gave that impression of being a guy. He knows how this all works, and he knows, all right, as long as these lawyers aren't morons, none of this is going to stick because it's all a joke.
Yeah. You know? I loved his line before they got to trial where he was like, so it took you long enough.
Yeah. Yeah. But, how long did it take you?
Yeah,
to figure out on your star witness.
Yeah,
I liked the super awkward scene between him and Frank Langella, where he says something about the law, and then Frank Langella wants to disagree, but he's like, "I'm not going to tell the former attorney general about this law thing."
Right. Yeah, where, you know, he could swing his judge peen around.
Yeah,
it's like oh, I can't really do that here with this guy. Yeah.
Because his whole thing, for all that he was this kind of terrible judge, what he was basing his own belief in his rightness was on the sanctity of the institutions, right? And yeah, this guy is the institution. So.
Well, that was the interesting thing was, and he set that up early on was when he felt disrespected, it was about the court. Right. You will not disrespect the court. They weren't saying anything disrespectful about the court. It was all about him. It was all about the judge.
Franklin Yeah. did a really good job too.
Yeah, he did.
Oh God, he did a real good job.
Fucking every Skeletor up there on the.
Yeah, every time I was like, God damn it, Nixon! Ugh, you did it to me again. Frost Nixon is a really good goddamn movie too.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So one of the things that struck me about this, the movie in general, especially with in terms of alongside Judas and the Black Messiah, it reminded me of a couple of years ago when what was it? The Darkest Hour and Dunkirk were both Best Picture movies because they both related to a certain periods and a certain point in time, and like. Though that attack was shown from two different points of view, one from the political, one from the actual. This in the same way with how Fred Hampton, is that right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With Fred Hampton being there and being present, but then also how his death kind of shook things up also, which so like immediately after the movie, I wanted to look up like what the truth and the fiction, you know, the fact and the fiction was on that.
Yep.
Apparently Sorkin played kind of fast and loose with some of the timeline of this because the trial did take so long.
Right.
Like he did things for creative effect. I mean, Fred Hampton did die during the trial, but it was months later than it was portrayed in this.
Yeah, was it actually after Bobby Seale got separated out?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But apparently Bobby Seale did confront the judge. He never said fuck you. but he did like call him a racist. And
yeah, so that scene where he gets beaten and then gagged, he was gagged for a full week of court appearances.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Like, well, they toned that down.
Yeah, and he actually did say, you know, take him to the room and like show it, like yeah,
whatever the
euphemism was.
It was like treat him how he deserves to be treated or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever the judge said was what he said.
Was the actual quote.
Yeah, they said there's a lot of it that was fictionalized, a lot of the relationship. Sometimes they had different characters being the one who said certain things to make the character more interesting. But from the article I read, the judge was the judge. Like they didn't really fictionalize that a whole lot, which is, I'm okay with that because he's clearly the villain of this. And this should all be part of public record, I would think. So why
sugarcoat
it? Why change it? Plus you can't really get in trouble making someone an asshole if they really were an asshole and it's all on record.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure that guy's dead by now, so it's not like he's going
to. Yeah. Yeah. He died in like 83.
Oh, no. That's when I was born.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Is that where his soul went?
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. We haven't talked about my boy Yaya yet.
No, we have not.
Hmm. God damn, I love that guy, even when he's not all blue. Yeah. Fuck, Watchmen was so good. He was really good in this. Every scene with him was really fucking good. He brought that fire.
Yeah, and apparently his whole thing about not having an attorney, that was all fact. He had a bunch of attorneys, and he fired them all except for the one guy, and then the one guy had the gallbladder problems. He couldn't be there, but that all really happened, and the judge was like, yeah, no, I don't give a shit.
Yeah
And in the context of the trial, and I should say I'm talking about a lot of this stuff, like, you know, I don't necessarily know where the fiction, you know, where the history ends and the fiction begins. But the depiction of the judge constantly trying to get Reuben and what was the other lawyer's name? Was it Weinstein?
Weingarten, I think. Let me look it up.
Time to open up IMDb and just leave it up.
Leonard Weinglass.
It was so many names. There's so many people in this.
Yeah, that's right. Reuben was the one of the defendants. It was Kunstler, William Kunstler, and Weinglass that were the defense attorneys. So trying to get them to just be his lawyer, right? And the judge keeps passing it off like he's just like it's just not common sense, right? Well, you're sitting right there, just be his lawyer. But the reality, of course, is that the instant he becomes that guy's lawyer, that guy is utterly linked to the rest of the defendants. And that's what they were trying to avoid, right? Because they, like he said, they threw him in there to scare the jury. He had nothing to do with anything.
Yep.
So, and that's why it was so critical that he not be represented by the same attorneys that the rest of the defendants were, was because even if it doesn't actually change any of the facts of the case, at that point in there is no more separating them in the eyes of the jury ever. And so you wind up with a guy who has no legal representation in a federal trial and is denied to be his own representation. And it's like, oof, that was, again, just very rough to watch the whole thing play out. But yeah, his energy was, it was this intense. He's clearly, you know, he has no respect for the authority of the court, but is trying so hard for so long to not let it get out of hand until that breaking point. And then it breaks and immediately it turns into a, you know, he's brutal. He has no, he has no rights. He's hauled off. He's physically assaulted. You know, it's the right of arms, essentially, that takes over.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great portrayal of that character.
Yep. My boy. Love that guy. Mm. What the hell else happened in this movie? I actually really liked the opening where they interspersed like the fictional shots with all of the news stuff.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring that up because they continue to do that periodically, like in the middle of the movie, less so, but especially at the beginning, at the end. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was done great. Like that, that can be real ham-fisted, but like during the march to the police station and then the riots, cutting between the film shots and the actual footage from historical events really made it feel like, even when you were watching the filmed shots, that it was, you were watching part of that historical event. It did a really nice job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's we're at a point in history, in this time period, where you have a lot of footage of these events, so you can just show what happened. You don't need to fictionalize it. You don't need to say people, oh, was it really that bad? Well, no, here, just watch the video. Like this is what happened. You know, we don't have to make it up.
This is them driving barbed wire into a crowd.
Yeah. Like that was so upsetting to see that. Like that was just brutal to watch. Like to see that truck with the barbed wire on the grill just coming at people. Like, holy fuck.
And you know how distant in the past this seems? It was
not very.
2 years before you were born, Tony.
Yeah, I know. I know.
That shit is wild.
Yeah.
That shit is, like, there are many people still alive.
So, like, only 30 years ago.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh.
Not quite.
Tony, I remember 30 years ago.
Yeah, I do too.
30 years ago was the 80s, not the 60s. Oh, wait.
No. I know. No. No. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about one thing that I I broke my rule about wanting something good to happen. I have a real hard time disliking Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, yes.
And that was just heartbreaking the whole movie.
Yeah. He portrayed the character that you want to like.
Yeah. Like, he's on the wrong side.
He's on the wrong side, but like, and he, from the very beginning, he portrays this character like somewhere in there, he doesn't think that this is the right move.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that this trial is being done for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But like, in the end, when the chips are down, he cares more again. And this is all about morals versus institutions, right? That's the big conflict here. And when the chips are down, he cares more about the institutions than the morals or ethics of any given situation. Yeah. That ultimately, if his superiors tell him he's got to prosecute these people and that they broke the law and the law is on the books, well, then he's going to do his job and he's going to get them sent to a federal prison.
He's Martin Luther King's white moderate, man.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, well, this isn't right, but I'm going to do it anyway because, like, we got to keep the status quo. Okay, great.
Yeah, it's a belief that the system is right because it's the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, realistically, I think at some point you go into being a prosecutor because you have that belief. Like you, I think at some level you have to have that a belief in that to do that. Unless you're, you know,
to do that.
That's the job that you can get, and your student loans are overwhelming. And, I mean, then again, this was the 60s, so he's probably already paid for, you know, with his, you know, waiting tables. He probably already had his bills paid.
Yeah, I had to keep being like, oh.
So it's not really an argument as much as an argument.
Every single young character in this is a boomer.
Yeah.
I had that same thought that, like, you can't be, well, and especially, like, a high position in the district attorney's of the United States' office, you don't get to that position unless you have an utter belief in the rightness that the system you're upholding is the ultimate good, that the worst thing that can be done is to rebel against the system.
Right. Well, you also wouldn't be put in a position of being a prosecutor for a trial like this unless you had been vetted and you were somebody who
reliable.
Believed in the system. Yeah. You know, as someone, you know, like, and, you know, in, there was an argument in, that was an interesting debate we had in a theology class. And it was over, like the belief in Mary as the mother of Jesus, you know, was she the most faithful person? So that's why she was chosen, or was she chosen and that made her the faithful person because she was chosen? You know, this guy was in that position. I don't think he was put in that position and then decided that he was going to stand up for this institution.
This was who he already was.
Yeah. You have to be that person, or you're not going to be given this high profile job. You're not, you know, somebody's cousin isn't just going to walk in and be prosecuting this trial. Yeah. They had a belief that he would be the one to support this and be the one to put these guys away. Yeah.
I mean, that's, they said that at the beginning, that we're picking you because you'll win this case.
Right.
Yeah. Which was weird for his boss to say, like, you're the assistant DA, so you're going to try this case. Yeah, but I'm the assistant DA. Like, we have a DA. It's you.
Yeah, but you also have the judge, and they know that the judge is just going to give you whatever you want.
Yeah.
And they did.
to the point that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character was frequently disturbed by how blatantly the judge was leaning to his side. But it was except for the one instance, where it crossed the line, watching Seal get dragged into the courtroom, gagged and bound.
Yeah,
that was just too much for him to bear. And frankly, you know, you can absolutely make the argument that you really had to let it get that far.
Yeah,
right. But every other instance where the judge And you could see it on his face, the way he portrayed the character, that he knew what was going on, but he was going to go with it. Like, he didn't think it was necessarily right, but he was going to roll with it because that was his job. And it his job was to win, and it was going to help him win.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this is, I think this is really just a, also a fictionalization of the prosecutor, because we know in actuality that Bobby Seale was in court for a week, bound and gagged. So that wasn't anything.
It wasn't like that was really the straw that broke the camel's back.
No. Yeah, that didn't seem to be a deal breaker.
And also, at the end, when in the movie, Tom Hayden is reading the names, it wasn't Tom Hayden that did it in actuality. It was nice for the story.
Yeah.
For it to work out that way. But in actuality, I'm trying to remember. I think it was
Dellinger.
I think it was Dellinger that did it. But in the story, we already had him hauled off. So, right.
He had his breaking point moment already.
Right. Yeah. He had his stand up and fight back moment, the peaceful, the pacifist who throws a punch.
He did not throw a punch in reality.
Right. Yeah. But when Dellinger read those names, the prosecutor didn't stand either. You know, it was I think it was a nice gimme for the audience to say, you know, even the prosecutor could recognize and be literally a stand-up guy. But they couldn't have gotten away with that had he not stood up for Bobby Seale when he came back into the courtroom, bound and gagged.
The problem is, you want to like Joseph Gordon-Levitt no matter what he's doing. And so, to make yourself feel better, you're like, oh, well, now we have to add this personal conflict here.
We've got to make him a little sympathetic.
Yeah, like, we got to put something. You can't hate Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Look at his face. He's just...
He's got two little girls.
You know how some people's faces are just really punchable?
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt's face is the opposite of that. It's just very likable. You just want to like... You want to like it. You just want to like his face.
Yeah.
It was a Sorkin film, so the dialogue was punchy and nice.
Yep.
Not nearly as much walking and talking as I'm used to, but you're in a courtroom, so not as many opportunities.
There was a lot of walking from the park to the police station.
So. That's true.
I think in terms of quantity of people walking, very high. Man, history sucks.
Yeah, well, you keep watching these. You keep wanting to watch these movies about terrible, terrible historical events.
Well, it's mostly just the '60s because I just read Stacey Abrams' book, and she has a long breakdown of like post Jim Crow in the South, and like the assumption that when the original Voting Rights Act was signed, like all the states just fell in line, but it took like years for the Southern states to actually provide any amount of voting support for
and lawsuits, I'm sure.
Years, lawsuits, like a lot of blood went into making
that. Yeah, I was going to say a lot of bloodshed too.
Yeah, a lot of blood went into making that happen. And like, since it's lapsed, you know, you roll, it's like the typical situation that we have in this country where it's like, we have all these voting protections, and then the states are lobbying to get rid of them. And they're like, well, we're already letting black people vote. Why do we need these protections? Let's just get rid of them. And it's like, well, what? You must want to get rid of them for a reason.
Yeah.
So they get rid of them. And they're like, okay, well, fine.
If the voting access wasn't a problem, you wouldn't care.
This is my problem with these goddamn people who are constantly complaining about regulations. Like, okay, but the regulation exists because this was already fucked up. It's not like it became fucked up after the regulations showed up. Like, no one's sitting around like, what voting regulations can we put in place to really fuck with the states? Like, that's not a situation. Except for the voter suppression stuff. Like, that is a situation. The world is awful right now, and it's just really frustrating. And this movie was set in the 60s, but if you told me this happened, like, last week, I would find very little involved here that could not have happened last week.
Yeah, it was distressingly not anachronistic.
Yeah. Like, when this dude in Minnesota is acquitted, and it will absolutely happen, he will not be convicted. That is, he will not be convicted.
Honestly, it's still a shock that anyone, it's a shock that a police officer gets indicted.
Yeah, it is surprising to me he is on trial. It's just like, that is amazing to me. And like when he gets acquitted, it's going to be the same thing as when Stockley was acquitted here. Like the whole protest cycle, which hasn't really ended, is just going to flare up and be like in the news again.
And then be used as an excuse to increase police presence.
Yep.
Kind of like actually the most recent example of that, where they're in the cycle of protests and an increase in the very thing that caused the problem, is the stuff going on over in the UK with, and I can't think of her name, but there was a woman who was assaulted by a police officer, and then the police officer basically faced no real consequences. And there have been protests, and the UK's government response has been, well, we'll put out a billion police officers to protect all the women. Okay.
This is the wrong... You've understood none of the problem and have presented a worse solution than currently existed. I don't know how we write this ship, kids.
You know what? We need a hero like Bernadine.
The hell is Bernadine?
She was the one answering the phone at the conspiracy office.
Hey, Tony, did that house look familiar to you?
What?
Did that house look familiar to you? Because I am 90% sure that's the house they use in Halt and Catch Fire.
Holy shit.
I'm on a 90%.
I'd need to go back and look. I'm 90%
sure that that's the same house.
Wow.
Because the layout's weird. The house is like... They didn't have to touch up or like de-age the house.
Yep.
I just assumed you were going for a Bonnie Tyler reference with needing a hero. So.
No, sir. I am a white woman. Yeah. Slept with several in my life so far. And on the balance, I have to say, yes, it is better. And to tell you the truth, I think that's a big part of what you've got. That's what you worked up. So much that it's bigger, it's just better.
Better.
You know what I mean?
Hang up the phone.
Was that a parting gift for Bobby? No, that was just for me. God, that was so good.
That was really good.
So I'm looking at some of the trivia on this, and at one point Spielberg was attached to this movie to direct it.
I am happy Spielberg did not direct this movie.
Yeah.
I am too. Well, apparently he had asked Sorkin to write the movie back in 2006. The writer strike kept it from happening.
Oh
my God. That was 2006.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that's only like 4 years ago, Adam, come on.
Right. Yeah.
He was scheduled to meet with Heath Ledger to play Tom Hayden. And the day before he was scheduled to meet him was the day that Heath Ledger died.
Oh.
He wanted Will Smith to play Bobby Seale.
Oh
yeah. That
no,
I don't like that look.
I don't think that's the right energy.
2006, you get Will Smith to play Bobby Seale. 2006, yeah. Will Smith is the Bobby Seale Will Smith. He's not currently the Bobby Seale.
No.
Yaya's my boy. That's who you get.
Michael Keaton was 68 years old when he filmed his performance as Ramsey Clark. The real Ramsey Clark was just 42 years old at the time. The time period he was portraying him.
Michael Keaton was really good. Goddamn good. He was really goddamn
that,
good.
That is a man who has aged well as an actor.
Yeah. Right?
He's in a select number of things, but it seems like everything he does turns to gold.
Ah, that scene in Homecoming, him and Spider-Man in the car.
In the car.
Oh, that scene's so good.
That is such a good scene.
So good. I wanted to rewatch it just for that scene. I couldn't find it. I was so pissed. But then I just watched the YouTube clip of that scene. I was like, oh, this is all I really need from the movie.
That's what the internet is for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I rewatched all the Marvel movies, and like, so what I think is, I rewatched all the Marvel movies before I watched the Snyder Cut. And what I think is, like, an understated crutch that Marvel uses is the progression of technology over the 10 years that all of the movies take place. 10? 15 years now? Almost 15 years that the movies take place now? Like, in Iron Man, there's nothing. But now you get to the end of Infinity War, and like, there's some crazy shit that Tony Stark has just put out into the world that just...
That's just accessible. Well, and honestly, the Marvel Comics universe, it's very reflective of their source material. Like, the Marvel has long had this thing where they build on ridiculous super tech that they invent for their comic books, and it just kind of becomes part of the fabric of the world. So I dig that, actually. That's one of the things that I like so much about the MCU, is the kind of not commented on, but background connective tissue that you see building through those movies. I'm actually in the middle of a rewatch of the whole MCU myself. I think we just did Civil War.
I rewatched Civil War. I watched Winter Soldier and Civil War specifically before watching Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Well, I mean, it's like one of those things that, like, so watching the Snyder Cut, like, it's a major problem that they have to travel to the other side of the world to get there to do this thing. And, like, it's a, like, 30-minute plot point because it's a 4-fucking-hour movie long, right? But, like, you never have that kind of boring-ass conversation in the Marvel movies because it's just assumed we can all get to wherever we have to go.
At a minimum, we've got a Quinjet on hand.
Yeah, like, they're just, everyone, like, everyone's got 4 or 5 in their pocket, just, like, just lousy with the Quinjets.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, we have to build a bigger parking lot because we all brought a Quinjet to work today. So, like, but it's just like, they don't have to spend time on the boring shit because they can just hand wave it away with technology.
Mm-hmm.
So...
But they did build up to it, too, right, with previous movies. You know, like you said, none of that existed in the first Iron Man, and even by Iron Man 2, the only real super tech was the suit. It was a major plot point, right? Mm-hmm. And then as Stark becomes more and more invested in changing the world, basically, you've got Quinjets, you've got, you know, whatever. You've got shield tech.
Yeah, putting repulsor technology on everything because we can. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we can.
Yeah, I actually rewatched Ultron, you know, just as part of
WandaVision,
because I forgot what the fuck happened in the movie. That movie's not nearly as bad going back.
I never thought it was that bad. Like, it definitely has some very cringy moments, and the overall, like, what is Ultron trying to accomplish is kind of, doesn't make a ton of sense.
Yeah,
but then he's an insane artificial intelligence that has no physical, no actual physical space. So, okay, he's crazy. Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's not that much different than the precursor to what Thanos does. Like,
sure. In the end, he settles on, you know what? I think I just got to wipe it all out and start over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, which I is mean, not is that
megalomaniac.
Much. Yeah.
You know, we've seen it with Ultron. We saw it with Thanos. Next, we'll probably see it with Doctor Doom. Like, that's...
I can only hope. God, yeah. I want a good Doctor Doom.
I want a good Fantastic Four.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, you repeat me. You can't have a good Fantastic Four without a good Doctor Doom.
Right.
In my mind, you can't disconnect the two. No. But yeah, honestly, Ultron's plan made more sense than... Zemo's plan in Civil War.
I don't know. I actually like Zemo's plan in Civil War.
I like Civil War a lot more than a lot of people I know. I know David.
It doesn't make any. It doesn't make any sense.
See, I don't have nearly as much of a problem with the character motivations in Civil War. It makes no sense. In spite of the fact that I do still find it aggravating. I think it's so much better than the comic book version of Civil War, where literally no one is acting like themselves at all.
Yeah.
But to me, the weakest part of Civil War is the actual bad guy and his plan. I don't think it makes like.
Oh no, I'm actually fine with that part. If they had just gotten something better than the Sokovian Accords to be the thing everybody disagreed about as the initial impetus for the Winter Soldier to drive the final wedge in, I'd have been fine with the movie.
Because that's really the thing, is that in the end, the Sokovian Accords is not what broke everything apart. It was the hunt for the Winter Soldier and mm-hmm. Steve being completely unable to live with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, you're current on Falcon and Winter Soldier, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm enjoying that show.
All right. So the first episode was all right. Sure. The second episode, when we get our buddy cop situation happening, was really goddamn good.
Yep.
And the whole... So in the previews, they cut together that staring contest. And, like, it was funny, but the... One, them scooting the chairs so close to each other was just so awkwardly hilarious to me. I could not stop laughing for like a good 5 minutes. They just keep scooting close to each other. But like the scene where he's like, hey, Captain America picked you and you gave up the shield. So if he was wrong about you, maybe he's wrong about me, was so fucking good.
That was really good.
Goddamn good. And then Anthony Mackie just does not engage.
Yeah.
That's the point. He's like, you know what? I'm out of this.
So. Yeah. I think we're done here.
That line was like on par with the grief is the, yeah. Is love persevering. Yeah. Like this show didn't deserve to have writing that good for that line. And his like that argument about if he was wrong about you, then what does that say about me? That's
well, I thought that was going to be a theme, but I was happy that we just said it and didn't have to go about this like long-winded situation, like WandaVision, like this long-winded emotional journey to get there, which I don't need from these characters. Like that's not what I want this like from this show, right? Like this is clearly just going to be them on some weird redemption arc.
Like it was good for WandaVision. Like for WandaVision, I think it was absolutely appropriate.
Yeah.
Because of where that character was. But no, I wanted this to be action. I wanted these two to act like the petulant teen brothers that they should act like. Because that's what it feels like. It's like, holy shit, that's Doug and I when we were like
So at 12 and
14 years old.
At the same time, what you're talking about with the therapy stuff and these are two fully grown dudes who have both had intense trauma to varying degrees.
Yeah.
And I actually do like the show slowing down enough to kind of dig into that a bit. Throughout, I mean, because it's not a movie. That's the thing. So Monica, one of her big complaints has with the MCU for a while now has been that she wishes the stories had time to spend with the characters just being themselves around each other more. And you know, my takeaway for that is, well, yeah, but they're movies, and since no one's insane enough to make a 4-hour superhero movie. You just don't have the time. If you're going to do the big superhero action stuff, you don't have the time to spend on scenes of just them hanging out with each other other than just sprinkled in very minimally, like in Age of Ultron, the party scene, right? You can only have a limited amount of that. And
party scene was really good though.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. It's often very good, and in longer contexts, that's meat and potatoes stuff. Is those character scenes as opposed to the big flashy action scenes? And for her, she's a big fan fiction reader, and that's what fan fiction often seems to be there for: is to give you space to explore those type of scenes that don't happen in a movie. Well, the TV shows have the time to do that, you know. When you're in a TV show, you can have multiple scenes throughout the course of a season of just the characters interacting with each other and talking, and you get into those characters' heads a little bit. And I think they've been doing it really well, even in Falcon and Winter Soldier. I really dig these characters. my I know your David, your peak MCU movie is still Thor Ragnarok, and I can't argue. But for me personally, my peak MCU movie is still Winter Soldier, the original, you know, Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
That's easily top five.
I'm a huge, you know, Cold War spy film type fan, and the aesthetic it had, the energy it had, plus just the, you know, the writing, the acting, it's all fantastic. So, and that's the vibe I get from watching Falcon and Winter Soldier, is that Captain America: The Winter Soldier vibe, and it's great. I love it so far.
Yeah, I love both of those movies for different reasons, and that's exactly how I love them. Like, they're two great movies for completely different reasons. They scratch completely different itches for me.
Yeah.
And like, I'm just not gonna rank them. Like, it's not worth it to me to rank them.
Like you said,
that's where I'm at with it.
It's a great thing. One of the complaints I have seen from people who just don't like the MCU as an idea or a concept is that, oh, well, every single movie that they make is the same. And I mean, I disagree with that intensely. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. Yeah, I don't want to watch the same movie over and over again. I want different experiences. So yeah, the fact that you've got such wildly different movies as Thor Ragnarok, Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and then even something like an Avengers movie, which is its whole own different entity. I think that's great.
Yeah, that's the thing that worries me most, is that I don't want an X-Men movie.
Really?
I have too much love for the X-Men. I don't want them as a movie.
Burned so many times.
I have so many times. I want an X-Men. I want an HBO, not HBO Max. I want an HBO series of the X-Men. Like, I want that level of, like,
you want Watchmen.
Watchmen. I want. Yeah. I do. I do. Mm-hmm. Because I think you can do it.
I think you can do it.
I think there's.
Yeah.
I think there's enough there. There's enough depth of character. And you don't need to change it. You can go back, because there's such a deep history, and you don't need to do any of the new stuff that's just crazy. Like, I can't even read the new comic books anymore. It's so different from what it was. Like, I just have no connection to it.
Here's what you do.
Can't connect to the characters.
You take the exact 90s cartoon. You punch it up a little bit, polish the edges. Do that as a live action show on HBO. Done.
I don't need the 90s cartoon, though. I'd go back to the source material, but keep the opening, but make it live action. Do a shot for shot remake of the opening, mm-hmm. but live action.
Do not touch the music up.
Don't at even all. Don't change the music. You know what? If the characters that are in the opening don't appear in the movie or TV show or whatever, that's fine.
That's fine.
I just or, you know what, even replace him with a character that will be in the show. Yeah, it's concerning to me, because those characters, so much of those stories, so much of the best parts of those stories were the things in between. The X-Men playing softball.
The girls' day out, where they just spend the whole issue in the mall.
Yeah. The guys going out to a bar and getting drunk, and, you know, Colossus getting the shit kicked out of him, and like Wolverine letting it happen because, you know what, he was being a dick and he needed to get beat down. It's like, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I really enjoy in a movie.
You
won't get it. There's no time.
Right.
There's just not time for it. And I do like Falcon and the Winter Soldier for that. They're letting us get more of that. And I have a feeling we're going to keep getting a new character introduced at the end of every episode. Like, I'm pretty sure the next episodes we're going to see Sharon Carter pop up. I have a feeling, because we had John Walker. Yeah, well, we had John Walker show up at the end of the first one. Zemo show up at the end of the second one. We know she's in it, so I'm pretty sure Sharon Carter is going to show up at the end of either this episode or... I mean, there's only six episodes, so we're already a third of the way through.
Oh, they're only doing six.
I didn't realize it was that short.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure it's only six.
I mean, if that gets us closer to Loki, I'm fine with that.
From my understanding, they're only doing...
passes the same way it passes.
Yeah, from my understanding, they're they're limiting these series to about 6 hours.
And WandaVision was a half hour show. Okay, I got you.
Well, and some of the later episodes corrupt a little longer, but yeah. Hmm. Yeah, they're doing about 6 hours of content per series. Whatever that means for the run times. They're, you know, but about that amount of story, I think, is story effects, you know, the budget for paying for these people, that kind of thing.
I suspect that might change.
I think it might.
Well, like, yeah. WandaVision was popular.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. I get the feeling, I mean, aside from the fact that it's a relatively new platform, and this is the, you know, the Marvel Studios' real first direct attempt at doing this, Netflix not taken into account.
And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. not taken into account.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with that show, but they clearly bailed on caring about that very early on.
Yeah, I agree. I'm right there with you.
It feels like this first batch of shows was a proof of concept more than anything. Like it feels like Feige wanted to see, all right, can we make this work? Let's do short, punchy series. Let's make it so that our investment doesn't creep beyond a reasonable level, mm-hmm. and see how it goes.
Yeah.
You also do characters that are minor in the scope of, like, they're the B characters from all these stories.
Yep.
They're characters that weren't explored in depth because these are the characters we mostly saw as characters that showed up, like in Wanda and Vision's case, they showed up because of the Avengers movies.
Right.
Like, they didn't exist outside of those movies. Bucky and Sam basically didn't exist outside of the Captain America movies. A little bit, but pretty much it was just those movies.
He was pivotal in Ant-Man.
Yeah. I do like the callbacks from that, too, that show up in Civil War.
Mm-hmm. First off, everything with Paul Rudd is wonderful.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the Ant-Man movies so far. They're really good.
Yep.
Surprisingly so. I was shocked how enjoyable they were the first time I watched them.
Yep.
Because I was expecting them to be like the throwaway movies for the MCU.
You know, I was expecting that out of Guardians of the Galaxy also. Mm-hmm. And then Ant-Man. And then it's like, oh, you guys just keep making good movies. So enough.
That's what I thought about the third movie, the third Thor movie. I was like, fuck, another Thor movie? Then I saw it opening night and immediately made my friends go to see it the next night.
Yep.
We have to see this movie tonight. I watched it yesterday. Let's go see it tonight.
Yeah, speaking of getting blindsided by the Guardians movie, I was not expecting to actually want to see the new Suicide Squad, and now I want to see the new Suicide Squad.
I'm right really there good. With you. Yeah.
It looks really good. Yeah. James Gunn knows how to make a movie, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, after seeing, like, I wasn't sure about him. Like, I knew of his pedigree, and then I watched the movie Super. Then I heard he was making a Marvel movie. I'm like, okay, let me see. Let me see what happens here. Cause like Super is so different. It's such a different kind of movie.
Shut up, superhero crime.
Shut up, crime. Yeah. I do enjoy that movie.
That movie is very good.
It's one of the few times that I really appreciate Elliot Page. Mm. Like,
oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, that was it. It's one of the times that the actor really seemed to enjoy themselves in a role. Most of the time, it just feels like it's a chore for them to act.
Yeah, they definitely.
Because it's a chore for me to watch them act.
Sure. So bad.
Yeah.
So bad.
I didn't feel that way about Super, though.
Have you started watching Invincible yet?
Not yet. I was going to this week, but I haven't done shit the last 2 days.
Because of birthday.
Birthday. Yeah. It's on my list. And
is that on
Prime? A short list?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I just started probably 3/4 of the way through the first episode.
Yeah. Well, I knew that it's like 3 episodes dropped the first day.
Oh, is it weekly? God damn it.
Yep. That's why I wasn't a huge for you. Yeah,
I hate that we've just reinvented TV.
Yeah.
Like I don't want TV anymore. I just like great. Now I have to pay money to like 18 different services, and commercials are starting to creep into those services that I can't avoid. It's like, well, fuck, we just reinvented cable.
Well, this is the a la carte service that the cable cutters were bitching about wanting 15 years ago.
Yeah, that was
more expensive.
Yeah. But this is what they wanted. This is exactly what they wanted. This is exactly what they were asking for. I want the ability to pick and choose everything that I watch and pay for them all separately. You don't want that. Well, I don't want the sports.
Because you'll want everything.
But, yeah. But you don't understand that getting some of those other channels actually helps pay for the stuff that you do want to watch. Like having the home shopping channel there actually pays for the other stuff.
That said, I still think for the moment at least, I am still paying a decent chunk less for my streaming services than I was paying when I finally cut ties with my cable provider.
Eric, we're still doing both in this house.
Ooh, okay, that's bad.
I haven't had cable in years.
Yeah, I keep trying. I keep trying, but Julie watches too many shows that you have to watch the night of or get ridiculously spoiled on. And like, she watches a lot of the live, like, and they're not live, they're still recorded, but like The Bachelor and that stuff that like will just be ruined, like is ruined within 15 minutes on Twitter. Yeah. Like if she waits like 45 minutes into a recorded show, like she waits a certain amount of time so she doesn't have to sit through commercials. But if you wait too much longer than that, she just starts getting spoiled all over the place. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing I just can't get her to pull away from.
Can't get her to cut ties.
I keep trying.
Thankfully, that never ended up being that much of a problem. In the end, the thing that was the hardest for us to cut ties with was not actually the cable service at all. It was the fact that we were going to have to give back our DVR machine, and we had so much stuff that we hadn't watched yet. And eventually, it just got to the point, like, we are paying so much money for shows that we're never going to get around to watching. We got to stop.
Yeah, you get to a point where it's like, let's just commit to the things that
we actually care about.
Yeah, commit to the things you care about. And if you really want to watch it, just let's cut the cord. And if it's on the DVR, make note of it. And then we'll just buy it.
Yeah.
Go buy the season.
Yeah, with as cheap as Blu-ray season costs these days. Yeah, like...
Well, not actually, even that, just streaming.
That was... Streaming. Even taking streaming out. Which now everything's so available through streaming. But yeah, that was actually the last straw when I realized, you know what? We will save like 3 box sets of Blu-rays a month by getting rid of this that we could just buy if we want to watch those shows. Why are we doing this?
Yeah. Yep. I watch very little television anymore. And the stuff that I do watch, we could watch on streaming. In fact, I do watch it on streaming services most of the time anyway.
Yeah. No commercials. Well, mostly now.
Well, I mean, even that, it's just like my other problem is once everybody goes to bed and I get the TV to myself, that's normally when I start playing video games. Sure. I'm like, because we have the PS4 hooked up to the big TV. So it's like, well, I could watch TV or I could stream TV tomorrow.
And play my video games.
Tonight.
Where's your PS5 hooked up to?
We don't have one yet.
You didn't win actually, one? I mean, that's how I got mine.
Dick, no.
Yeah, that is unbelievable, by the way.
Yeah, Julie was like, I was going to get you a PS5 for your birthday. And I was like,
well, were you?
I mean, for one thing, you probably couldn't get one. No, I couldn't. I was like, well, that's fine. Because also, I still have games on the PS4 that I'm playing. It's fine. And like, yeah. I've played so much Assassin's Creed lately. Like, I think I'm in like getting close to the 150 hour mark of Odyssey.
Oh my God.
I'm playing the DLC now. which is actually a shit ton of fun. I'm running around in Hades now. I've been to Tartarus, Elysium. Yeah, it's.
I fought my way out of there.
Yeah, it's. I'm actually having a lot of fun with it.
Use the shield. That's the best yeah. weapon.
The shield is the best weapon.
But I'm to the point where when I'm done, I'm going to take a break from the PS4 for a while. So I'm like, it's fine. Don't get it. Just
wait, Tony, you have played Hades, right?
Hmm?
Hades?
No. Oh, no, I have not.
Oh,
so good. I have
not.
Oh, Tony.
I have not.
Tony. Oh, here's another game that's really good and weird and fucked up for, and actually your laptop shouldn't probably have a problem playing it either. Disco Elysium.
Oh, I played Disco that about 6 Elysium. Months ago.
It's so fucking weird.
It is. It's just, it is. Like, it is too weird to describe.
Yeah, it's like off-putting.
It's at its heart, it's telling a very hard-boiled noir murder mystery story.
Huh. Yeah.
But it is so weird.
Yep. It's so weird.
You
wake up honestly, from a night of a bender. And you don't know anything about yourself, and your character doesn't know anything about yourself.
Yeah, your character basically wakes up from a bender with total amnesia, and they play it off by having you know nothing about what's going on either, and they don't bother explaining it to you.
Like Planescape Torment.
That kind of thing, yeah, only without the...
Waking up dead?
Well, no, yeah. Without having D&D to fall back on it. Like, you know, people, you could know what Planescape Torment is about. Yeah. This is... a completely original setting, so you will right. not know until you discover by playing the game what's going on.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I would love another game set in that world.
It was fascinating. It was.
So I was telling David as we started recording that I was looking at email because I didn't look at email for the last 2 days. And I didn't get around to saying this. I see that Evil Genius 2 just dropped on Steam.
Oh, Tony, I've already got 7 hours in it.
I'm not surprised.
It's Evil Genius 2.
Oh, I guess I'll be getting it then.
Eviler Geniusier?
Evil Genius 2, World Domination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they actually, a streamer that I think is really goddamn funny... was playing it the other day, and he's like, well, if you use my code, I get something from the developers or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll just use your code to pre-order it then. And then, like, I got there, and it's like, oh, you've already pre-ordered this. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. That sounds like something I'd have done 6 months ago.
Yeah, I didn't pre-order it, but I see it's already on sale, so...
10%.
Yep. I'll be doing that here shortly.
But yeah, I also recommend Disco Elysium. It's phenomenal.
It's really good. It's a lot of reading.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not voice acted like hardly at all, which is weird, but also adds a certain amount of charm.
Sure.
It makes it there's a certain sense of distance in the game, and that's honestly it's part of the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. It's very weird.
It's supposed to feel a little, I don't know, almost like the whole game is metaphorical, and that's intentional. That sensation, or surreal. I mean, it's a very surrealistic game.
Well, I will check it out. I will add it to my list.
I think you'd enjoy it, Tony.
All right. So, Devs.
Devs was really goddamn good.
I told you.
Oh, Nick Offerman is so talented. Fuck.
Have you seen this yet, Eric?
I have not. Is this the TV show that's like about people who literally like write a world or something like that? I think I've seen commercials for it. Or...
You probably saw commercials that were really obtuse. Mm-hmm.
To be fair, the show is more obtuse than that.
Yeah, it's. I would recommend watching it and not looking too much into it before you do. Just going cold.
Similar to the movie for tonight, I honestly, I try to do that as much as humanly possible. I find that I enjoy media more the colder I go into it these days. I've been on the one trailer rule for years and years now, for movies.
Yeah, I saw the commercials for this ages ago, and
it's an Amazon show, right?
No, it was FX. On FX, but it's on Hulu.
Okay,
you can pick it up on Hulu.
That's right.
So I saw the commercials for it, and I keep like this master list of things that I know I'm not going to watch right away. So I just put it on the list. I've been watching a lot of things
I have a similar watch list of like, I know these are shows I would be interested in, but I have no time for them. So they go on a list and someday I'll get to these. And the past 12 months, I have watched so many of those shows.
Yeah. So I found out that it was an 8-episode season and
so short.
It is complete there. At this point, there are absolutely no plans for a second season.
Good.
It was actually in the early press. It was out. It was put out as a the advertising for it was that it was a limited series. Later, FX started slipping in season one, but Alex Garland, the guy who wrote and directed, he's like, well, there's not going to be a season two, so you can call it season one, but
I don't want a season two.
I don't want a season two either. It is a complete story. Have you seen Ex Machina?
No.
Okay. It's the same guy who did Ex Machina. He wrote the novel that The Beach was based on, which I actually kind of, he's got a couple of novels out there, and I'm actually considering picking him up on Audible just because they're all themes. They're these big themes of identity and, what makes a person a person. I'm not going to say too much more because I don't want to delve into things that you haven't seen too much. I cannot recommend Devs enough.
Yeah, his writing credits include The Beach, 28 Days Later, Sunshine,
28 Days Later,
Dread, really? Annihilation, really? Ex Machina. Yeah,
holy cow, that's a lineup.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
I rewatched that Dread movie, and it's still really fucking good.
The Carl Urban one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That.
Yeah, he wrote that.
Yep.
Yeah.
He wrote Sunshine, and that was a goddamn movie. Wait, hold on. Was this the one? Yeah, this is the one we watched.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a goddamn good movie too.
Yep. There's a scene that happens in the second episode, and it's a conversation between two characters. It's just so good. And it's a boomer versus millennial conversation, but like, it does not go the way you think it's going to go. it's really good. Yeah. When you get a chance to see it, let us know. And I think we can have a good discussion about that one.
Okay.
Yep. I would like to discuss it.
Yep. I will refrain from it now for Eric's sake.
For spoiler purposes.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's something that, you should go into cold.
I knew nothing about it, and I was pleased that I did not.
All I knew about it was that Nick Offerman was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the commercials look cool
on its own face.
Yeah, the commercials looked cool and funky, and like, I have a vague recollection of a commercial with this gigantic human in it, like a gigantic human child in it, and like, it was like, I don't understand what this is. This looks weird and fucked up.
And that's exactly what it is.
It's not as fucked up as it could be.
It's weird.
It's weird, but like, at the end, I think they earn the weird.
Like, well, I'm all for short and punchy and done. Any show that knows itself well enough to say, this is the whole story I had to tell, and we're going to stop now.
Yeah. Yeah. This feels like a novel just made into a movie, but a TV show, I mean, that's the problem I had with like it was the blessing and curse of American Gods was that it was one novel and they just kept adding to and expanding on and milking. And it's like,
that first season's really good.
I like the second season also.
The second season starts to meander.
Third season is just,
The third season, they fire Orlando Jones because there's too much race stuff. And then they do no interesting things. Not with race, just no interesting things. And then I stopped watching it.
And so it was weird because there was more race stuff. It felt like there was more race stuff in the third season after Orlando Jones was fired. Like, there was both more and less. It was a more diverse cast in the third season.
Yeah, but then you had that weird scene between What's-His-Face and the cop, and it was just like, this is weird. I don't like this.
Yeah.
I want Orlando Jones shouting at people.
Well, it doesn't matter because it was canceled. So, good. Yeah. It didn't resolve, and it's been canceled. But, like, if I remember the book correctly, there was only, like, nothing left.
Minimal left, yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't really a whole lot left of the story. Are you familiar with the book, Eric?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I read it.
All right. So if I remember the book correctly, him being tied to the tree is, like, pretty much the end of the story. Like, we're really close to the end.
Yeah,
that's where, like, season three is. Like, that starts the last episode of season three. I had this real problem with the last couple of episodes of season three in that I kept falling asleep. Like, they get so weird and trippy that it was just, like, hypnotic, and I just, like, doze off. Like, there's just no content. We're just being weird and doing weird visuals for the sake of having weird visuals.
Yeah, though every time I think about the American Gods show, all that I think about is that I really need to sit down and actually watch the Good Omens TV show sometime.
Oh, you haven't seen that yet?
No, I haven't watched
it. Damn, Eric.
I know. That's a good one.
It is. Yeah, that's a really good one. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, David Tennant and Michael Sheen have really good chemistry. Just
and not having watched the show, it felt like that was a show that, again, kind of knew when what it wanted, what story it wanted to tell, and how to stick to it.
Yeah, the story.
Yep. Yeah, having fucking John Hamm show up as another angel was just because he plays, is it Michael or Gabriel? One of them. He plays one of the big archangels.
One of the big names.
Yeah. One of the name angels.
I did not like 50% of that book. There's, like, the plot, and then there's all these side characters for the plot, and
I mean, that's Terry Pratchett. That's just how he writes his books.
Sure. Well, Gaiman should have fixed it. We don't need all of these side characters. This story is boring. Let's not do it.
I enjoyed it, and it's all pretty much there in the TV show also.
Oh, I know.
You got some friends there, David.
Yep. Other side.
Yeah, well, they're both on my shit list right now. They're not. They're never on my shit list. I don't know what they're doing. There must be a bug or something in
here. So we got anything else about the movie?
Nope. Other than it was good.
It was good. Good actors, good writing. Very aggravating, and nothing and nothing has changed in 50 years. 40 years, 50 years.
50.
It's, oh, it's 50. Yeah.
53 years? Because wasn't the...
From the actual right.
68, yeah. Yeah. All right, let's call it a night. Next week, we're talking about Mank, also a Netflix movie.
Oh, this was a Netflix movie, right?
Yes.
Did it beat our two-thirds rule?
Yes, I think it did.
I think so, too.
I think it did.
That's right. I remember you guys talking about this two-thirds rule when we discussed Devil All the Time.
Yes.
Which is what? It's like two-thirds of a good movie, something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I look at it as acting, plot, effects, story. I mean, those are four things, but it feels like one of them is missing and the other one is just lacking, which brings us to two thirds. Like, I think
real complicated math.
It is.
Now I'm picturing Tony's
story Tony's are that, somehow two things.
Tony's well, that meme of the equations and
it is. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
No, I think this one blows it out of the water. There was no real I mean yeah. Apparently though, God, where was it? I closed that tab. One of the actors wanted to be tear gassed and to be thrown to the ground like by the police. Oh yeah, Jeremy. Here it is. Yeah. Jeremy Strong, Jerry Rubin,
there we go.
Begged Aaron Sorkin to get him tear gassed as well as being thrown to the ground by an ex-cop portraying a riot police officer. Sorkin refused to have this happen on set. The guy's
that
a
doesn't mean
actor.
He didn't arrange it.
No, it doesn't. He just refused to let it happen on set.
That does feel like a thing Sorkin would arrange too.
Like, well, yeah. Let's meet me out back after after shooting today.
I know a guy.
Ugh. Well, I guess right. We'll find out if Mank holds up then.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We're actually getting to the point now where more than 2/3 of the movies we've watched don't follow the 2/3 rule. So the math is starting to get very complicated.
See, the thing is we've chosen movies that are the Oscar nominated movies. So it feels like these are the ones that are bucking the trend because we're not picking all the Netflix movies to go through.
Oh yeah.
I have a feeling if we were just doing like the Netflix movie of the week, mm-hmm. we'd see a lot more of the 2/3 rule coming into play.
Yeah. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was the other one we did.
Yes.
Recently.
Yeah. The reason I picked these last two movies, this one and next week's, was because they're on the best picture list.
Yeah.
It made it easy. It's an easy list to pull from.
Ooh, I watched Black Panther like shortly after we watched Ma Rainey's, and like, ooh. It is tough seeing Chadwick Boseman after.
Yeah,
it is tough.
Yeah,
well, yeah,
that,
it's
God, that guy, and talk about. I mean, that guy was working his ass off all through all of that. That is,
yep.
Mm-hmm.
Died just weeks after filming ended on Ma Rainey's.
Yep.
All right, on that note.
Yep.
on that cheery note.
Yeah. All right, we'll see you guys next week.
Yep. Okay.
See you.